It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S.-India relations in the aftermath of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the United States. We'll also take a brief look at prospects for greater stability in neighboring Afghanistan as Afghanistan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, signed the long-awaited bilateral security agreement, authorizing deployment of a small international military force in the country after the end of 2014. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. This was Prime Minister Modi's first visit to Washington. It was aimed at strengthening political and economic ties between the world's oldest and biggest democracies. He came to the U.S. Capitol from New York, the first stop on his five-day visit to the country that denied him an entry visa in the past, because of accusations that he failed to stop religious violence in Gujarat in 2002 when he was chief minister there, which took the lives of more than 1,000 people, most of them Muslims. The United States and India agreed to forge closer defense and security ties, but evidently the talks didn't produce a breakthrough on disagreements that have hobbled ties in recent years. Mr. Modi was in the United States to, quote, sell a new India, with himself as the man who could be trusted to deliver on its promise. However, analysts say it remains to be seen whether he is willing or able to bridge India's wide differences with the United States on tax policy, climate change, outsourcing, intellectual property rights, and other issues. There is a large Indian diaspora in the United States, which is a key constituency in U.S. politics, as well as an important business and cultural link between the United States and India. Well, for more on the significance of Prime Minister Modi's visit to the United States and to what extent it can help revive and rebuild this important relationship, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Michael Kugelman is Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. That's a think tank here in Washington. Michael also publishes op-eds, commentaries, and blog posts in many major newspapers. Also joining us is Sadanand Dume. He's resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a think tank also based here in Washington. And Sadanand Dume is also a South Asia columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and he previously worked as the Indonesia correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Well, Michael Kugelman, let me begin with you talking about both the symbolism and substance of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit here in the United States, his reception by the Indian diaspora in New York in particular. Talk about the significance of this visit.
I think that this visit was very significant and really successful just because it happened to start with. We have to remember, it's easy to forget with all the hoopla surrounding Modi's visit, that this is a relationship between the U.S. and India that was really in trouble in recent months, particularly at the end point of last year. And so President Obama invited Modi to come here to the U.S. right after he was elected and became prime minister, and Modi accepted. He could have declined or he could have waited, but I think that the fact that he accepted the invitation and came here and spent several days in this country is significant. It means that he's willing to put behind, you know, the baggage involving his own issues with the visa ban and all that stuff. And I think it suggests that he's ready to move on and get this relationship back on track. And the fact that Washington rolled out the red carpet in so many different ways, both in terms of official Washington, but also in terms of corporate officials wanting to see Modi and engage him, suggests that Washington is really serious as well. So, sure, there may not have been a milestone achievement or anything like that. I don't think anyone was really expecting that. So the fact that the visit happened is a big achievement.
Sadanand Dume, turning to you for your take on the significance of this visit, the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Nicholas Burns, says that in strategic terms, there are few countries more important to Washington than India, the dominant power in the Indian Ocean region, and with Japan, the most important U.S. partner in Asia, seeking to, what he says, limit Chinese assertiveness in the region. How do you see this relationship? Do you see it as that important? And therefore, to what extent did this visit serve as a springboard for further consolidation of the relationship?
Well, that's a great question, Carol. I agree with Ambassador Burns. This is a relationship of great strategic significance to the United States. India is a large country, a democratic, pluralistic nation, and it's not just President Obama. For the last three administrations, the United States has seen the importance of India and tried to build a closer partnership with India because there's a real confluence of interests, not just in terms of containing overt Chinese aggressiveness in Asia, but also in terms of promoting democratic values and a market-based economy as opposed to a Chinese-style state-based capitalism. Now, as Michael pointed out, the relationship has been rocky at times, and the significance over here really was in terms of pressing the so-called reset button. And I think that reset button has been pressed quite successfully by both countries.
Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, for a readout on some concrete outcomes. So if the reset button was in fact pressed, what were some areas of agreement and significant outcomes?
I would highlight two, one being an announcement of cooperation on climate-related issues and renewables. These are areas that for a number of years the two countries have been engaging, but I think that Prime Minister Modi really is taking these things seriously. He's done a lot of work, or had done a lot of work, in Gujarat, the state that he was chief minister, to focus on renewables, particularly in terms of solar. So I think that both countries really see this as low-hanging fruit. And secondly, security cooperation. I think it was very significant that both leaders specifically referred to militant groups, terrorist groups, based in Pakistan that are major threats to India. And both leaders said that they were going to cooperate in dealing with these groups. It's actually a very dramatic statement, but I think it's significant and shows that they really want to take their security cooperation a bit further.
What about the areas of disagreement on which much more work has to be done?
Sure. I think this visit, in an effort to make it a feel-good type thing, there wasn't really too much discussion of possible tension points. But certainly there's a lot to work on, particularly in terms of economic policies. Both countries accuse the other of using protectionist-type policies that make it very difficult for products to get into the other countries. And the U.S. investment community is particularly unhappy with an environment in India that many American business people consider to be very detrimental to FDI in terms of heavy red tape, things like that.
Foreign direct investment.
Foreign direct investment. And certainly this is something that Modi has said he wants to work on. He emphasizes repeatedly in his meetings with business leaders here. But certainly these are still areas that are going to need to be worked on in the months ahead.
Turning to you, Sadanand Dume, for your take on some specific outcomes, positive agreements, whether, as Michael Kugelman said, on defense, security, climate change, what do you see as having materialized?
You know, there were a few specific things. I would also highlight the cooperation against some of these Pakistan-based terrorist groups. That was quite specific. There's also going to be greater cooperation in terms of defense. The U.S. is going to help India set up a national defense university. But all in all, Michael is absolutely right. This was not a relationship that was heavy on specifics. It was heavy on symbolism. Mm. This was really about setting the mood music. And what we're going to have to look at in the months ahead is to see how much setting that mood music in fact affects the concrete deliverables. So the short answer is we haven't seen that yet. I personally am hopeful that we are going to see more concrete outcomes emerge over the next 6 to 8 months. But for now, this visit should not be viewed in terms of having really achieved a lot in concrete specific terms.
And on the areas of disagreement, what do you see are the challenges ahead,
well,
particularly?
I think some of these economic disagreements I'm quite optimistic about, for the simple reason that, you know, these really came to the surface partly because of domestic problems in India. India's economy was growing very fast. It was growing at almost 10% a few years ago. And then it dropped dramatically to less than 5%. It kind of halved in its growth rate. And when the economic growth halved, it was like a tide had receded. And suddenly problems that had always been there became more prominent. If Modi can indeed boost India's growth, and if he can deliver on his promise to make India an easier place in which to do business with less red tape, he always talks about rolling out the red carpet and getting rid of red tape. If he can deliver on his promise, I think American business will be much happier. The sticking points have been just a general difficulty in doing business. India is 134th in the world on the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business report. It's just a tough place to get things going. There have also been problems with India's intellectual property right laws. And many American companies feel, justifiably in my view, that the Indian patent laws, which were meant to bring India more in line with the rest of the world in terms of how it considers intellectual property, have in fact lagged in that regard.
Back to you, Michael Kugelman. Talk about the significance of the Indian diaspora here in the United States. How important are they as a bridge, and also their significance as a constituency for U.S. politicians?
Yeah, I don't think one can overstate enough the significance of the Indian diaspora in the United States for this bilateral relationship. As you say, it serves as a bridge in so many ways. And to highlight one thing in particular is that the Indian American community has a very strong lobbying presence. I mean, obviously, it's a very large diaspora to start with, so that helps. But it just has an ability to have a significant impact on Capitol Hill, like few other diaspora groups do. And I think that's important because, for the most part, this is a constituency that wants this relationship to work. And particularly in terms of the business side, many of the members of the diaspora in this country are in the private sector and are trying to find ways to help bring the countries closer together in terms of better economic cooperation and so forth. So I think that's one of the various reasons why Modi decided to have this huge spectacle at Madison Square Garden, you know, almost 20,000 people, most of whom are Indian American. I think he was essentially trying to engage them, obviously, but also just to highlight the fact and emphasize the fact that he realizes how critical they are for this relationship.
Back to you, Sadanand Dume from the American Enterprise Institute, on the importance of the Indian diaspora here in the United States as that bridge. Are many of the investors we're talking about from that community, and, you know, to what extent can they use their leverage to push forward this relationship?
You know, Carol, one of the most striking images for me of the visit was Prime Minister Modi in Madison Square Garden, surrounded by about 40 members of Congress. Now, there's an election approaching, and for 40 members of Congress to show up in New York, obviously not all of them are from New York, and be there on that stage with the Prime Minister tells you something about the growing importance of the diaspora in terms of linking the two countries together. The Indian diaspora traditionally has not been important directly in terms of business. Most of these people are not businessmen. It's quite different, in fact, from the Chinese global diaspora. Indian diaspora are professionals. These are often doctors, lawyers, consultants. They've done very well in this country. But the main significance is in terms of, I think, transmitting ideas to India. India is a country that was socialist for such a long time. And here you have a community that has really thrived in the world's most capitalist country.
We'll have more in just a minute. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Sadanand Dume, from whom you just heard. He's Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We're talking about the U.S.-India relationship in the wake of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to Washington. We'll also be talking in a little bit about prospects for stability in the wake of the new Afghan government and the signing of the bilateral security agreement. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with me on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Syed Abdelbaki. He's from Manama, Bahrain. Thanks for listening, Syed. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email with comments and feedback to encounter@voanews.com or comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Michael Kugelman, and we'll stick with India for a minute more or two with respect to, for example, Afghanistan, as we'll be talking in a minute about the bilateral security agreement. Will India, under Narendra Modi, continue its strong relationship with Afghanistan? And will that remain as a bit of a sticking point for Pakistan? So we have a new government in Afghanistan under Ashraf Ghani, relatively new government under Narendra Modi in India. What is the impact of that on relations in the region, and particularly with Pakistan?
Well, India and Afghanistan have a long-standing relationship, and they signed a strategic partnership accord a few years back. So certainly, India's diplomacy and engagement with Kabul will continue, if not intensify. Certainly on economic levels, investment levels, it will continue to the extent that it can. There have been some suggestions that India may want to intensify its security cooperation with Afghanistan, which at this point is really limited to providing training and advice to security forces. I don't know if it would necessarily go that far, but certainly, as you say, Pakistan is not happy and is very concerned on many levels with this idea of India having a presence in Afghanistan, and certainly the idea of it intensifying its presence. And I think the question is, how far would Narendra Modi be willing to go to deepen engagement with Kabul without provoking Pakistan, which I think Modi really would not be too concerned about when it comes down to it. But at the same time, I think that he doesn't want a already unstable situation in that part of the world to grow even more so. And also, let's face it, I think in the coming months, Afghanistan's stability could intensify. And I think Modi would keep that in mind because a lot of these destabilizing forces are anti-India forces. And if there was more of an Indian presence, that could certainly mean Indian nationals, Indian lives would be more at risk in Afghanistan.
Turning to you, Sadanand Dume, for your analysis of how the new government in Afghanistan under Ashraf Ghani and, of course, Abdullah Abdullah and Narendra Modi, how will that play out? Will we see an intensifying of a relationship? And will that, to some extent, antagonize Pakistan? Or how do you see this trilateral relationship?
I think you'll certainly see a continued strengthening. India is very deeply invested in Afghanistan. The Indians helped build Afghanistan's parliamentary building. India has been, I believe, the fifth largest aid donor in Afghanistan. And the stability of Afghanistan has deep implications for India's own security. India enjoys a positive relationship both with Mr. Ghani and with Mr. Abdullah Abdullah. And in general, the new Afghan government shares Indian concerns about instability that is seeping into that country from Pakistan, specifically a resurgence of the Taliban. So cooperation is going to continue. And again, concerns in Pakistan about that cooperation are going to continue. I think by and large, though, the sort of sensible middle ground has been so far that India helps Afghanistan in its development efforts, but India doesn't include any kind of overt military presence in Afghanistan. So, for example, there are no Indian boots on the ground. I believe that will continue, and I hope that the Pakistanis view this sensibly, which is that it's actually good for Pakistan, if they look at this objectively, for Afghanistan to be standing up on its own feet.
Indeed. Before we turn to Afghanistan, one last question, and that's to you, Michael Kugelman. Generally speaking, do you see this visit on the part of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi the start of a more vigorous India-U.S. relationship, and particularly with respect to India as a so-called counterweight to the growing assertiveness of China in the South and East China Seas? Do you see them, that is, India, playing that role?
I certainly see this visit as the beginning of some very good things for the bilateral relationship. But along the lines of what you suggest, I'm not sure. Certainly, we hear this idea, this notion that Washington would look to New Delhi to help balance out China's rising clout in Asia. But let's face it, Narendra Modi has no interest in provoking China. This is someone that has oftentimes expressed his support and even admiration for China, and particularly for its economic model. Modi made, I believe, one or two visits to China while he was chief minister of Gujarat. So the idea of strategically having his country try to help support, carry out U.S. strategic goals of balancing out China seems to me a bit hard to believe. And then there's also the broader notion of, would India want to actually band together with the United States, perhaps with Japan, and try to balance out China? It would seem to go against the grain in terms of India's traditional foreign policy views, you know, as a leader of the non-alignment movement, that type of thing. So to me, you know, sort of moving toward the United States to help pursue U.S. goals in that way, I'm not sure if that's going to happen.
Turning back to you, Sadanand Dume, do you see the visit as jump-starting a more vigorous relationship? And what are your views with respect to India under Narendra Modi as a some sort of a counterbalance, as we discussed earlier, to China?
You know, I think this counterbalance idea tends to get overstated. Nobody in the U.S. or nobody in foreign policy circles thinks that India is going to stand up and say, well, we're going to fight China with you shoulder to shoulder. And frankly, no one in the United States wants that either. The United States also wants a cooperative relationship with China. The thinking really is that if India rises, if you have this large democratic country that is doing well, it automatically creates a different picture in China.
Good point.
It's not that India has to actively be out there countering China or going to it with China. And I think that is the sort of larger thinking behind the U.S. outreach to India on this particular issue, not that it's going to become an explicit adversary of China.
Okay, very good. Turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, and turning now to Afghanistan, what's your view of this new government under Ashraf Ghani and now Abdullah Abdullah as his so-called partner? Can this work? Do you see the two collaborating? They were such strong adversaries in this very contested election. How do you see the government and its stability going forward?
It's certainly a very noble experiment, the idea of these two bitter rivals essentially working together. The whole arrangement, this whole idea of a national unity government is a bit of a powder keg for the reasons you mentioned. And also, these two politicians have supporters who in some cases are very hardline and polarizing and could seek to sabotage this arrangement. But I think that ultimately, a lot of people seem to think that there would never be an agreement, that they would never agree to this unity government. And they did. And I think that's really an example of them essentially putting the interests of the country above their own political interests. But at the same time, we have to keep in mind that many Afghans braved Taliban threats to go out to vote, and they voted for one leader. They wanted one person to be leading the country, not two, including someone that they probably don't like in many cases. So there certainly is reason to be concerned, but the fact that the government is in place and international support is therefore sustained and intact, I think that at least for now, we could be cautiously optimistic about Afghanistan in the sense of this unity government.
Sadanand Dume, do you think that these two political rivals can work harmoniously together and having the international support as an incentive to do so?
Color me skeptical, right? I mean, unless for some mysterious reason Afghan politics is this wonderful, gentle thing that is completely different from everybody else's politics everywhere. These people were rivals. They fought each other. They probably hate each other. I'd like to be optimistic. I'd like to share Michael's optimism, but I find it very hard to imagine that this jerry-rigged contraption in Afghanistan is going to last very long.
Back to you, Michael. Well, this so-called jerry-rigged contraption, this forcing of the two to work together, is it possible that the threats to Afghanistan from the Taliban, the disintegrating economy, would they somehow see these threats as more important and as an incentive to work together, notwithstanding their differences? Give us a sense of the threat by the Taliban right now. They are obviously not happy about the bilateral security agreement which was signed, this long-delayed agreement that former President Hamid Karzai refused to sign. So this is obviously another very positive development. How do you characterize the threat from the Taliban and, of course, the economy?
Yeah, well, certainly both the economy and the Taliban are threats, and for different reasons. The Taliban threat seems to be rising in the sense that you've had areas of the country that have been quiet in terms of insurgent violence heating up in recent months. And I think that Taliban forces are testing Afghan security forces, which are fighting without international combat support now. And I think they want to see how far they can go. And I think they're finding that they are going quite far. And I think it's important to highlight here that this bilateral security agreement calls for about almost 10,000 troops to remain. That's great. It's a psychological boost, but 10,000 troops is not going to stabilize the country, particularly because these troops are not going to have a combat role. So that's a threat. And in terms of the economy, yes, absolutely. I mean, the economy has really been floundering for a good number of months. The fact that there's finally a new government in place will hopefully provide a bit of stabilization in that regard. And the fact that U.S. and international economic support should continue is also encouraging. But this support will probably be less than it had been. And until a lot of these structural problems in Afghanistan are dealt with, like corruption, I think dealing with the economy is going to be a big, big challenge. And particularly if you have two bickering leaders at the top, not being able to get anything done in that regard.
Well, now Michael is sounding like the skeptic, just like you.
Yeah, I think I've been won over.
Okay. Sadanand Dume, again, your take on these major obstacles to progress, and how do you characterize the Taliban's gains, and could they continue, or will the government and, of course, its own security forces, which have been quite valiant in the face of these threats, and now this bilateral security agreement, which guarantees a presence of approximately 12,000 combined U.S. and NATO personnel, even if in a more advisory capacity. Can that, in the long run, trump the threats by the Taliban?
That's a really good question. I think that all people can agree that we would be more optimistic about the security situation in Afghanistan if there were a more robust U.S. and NATO presence over there. Now, I am not certain about the fighting capabilities of the Afghan army. It's certainly true that on the face of it, Taliban gains do seem quite alarming. But it's also true that as a historical precedent, there was a time when people had written off Najibullah, but he actually managed to hang in for several years.
Najibullah,
the former communist strongman in the 1990s in Afghanistan. So, I mean, the real question is, are we going to see some kind of replay of the 1990s where the Taliban sweep into power and capture Kabul? I think not. On the other hand, are we likely to see a return to significant combat and much less security than we had seen a few years ago? Unfortunately, that does seem likely at this moment.
And the last question back to you, Michael Kugelman, then. What about the possibility of the Taliban, or the good Taliban, so to speak, joining peace talks? We know that Ashraf Ghani is in favor of bringing the Taliban in to peace talks, those that, of course, renounce violence and obey the constitution, etc. I don't know that Abdullah shares his view. What are the prospects?
Yeah, it's true that Ghani and Abdullah see differently on this issue of peace talks. I have never been particularly convinced that the Afghan Taliban is really genuinely interested in pursuing peace talks, particularly now with international combat troops heading for the exits. Why would the Taliban want to step off the battlefield when it feels it can do so well on the battlefield? It would seem to not make sense to stop fighting and try to go to the peace table. And also, the Afghan Taliban is a very fractured organization in the sense that, you know, you have moderate forces within the group that are interested in peace talks, but then you have more hardline and powerful members of the Taliban. And it has never been clear to me if Mullah Omar, who's the supreme leader of the Taliban and who is seen within all of these fractious groups within the Taliban as the supreme leader, it's never been clear to me if he himself is in support of the idea of peace talks. And I don't think he will be anytime soon.
The last word to you, Sadanan Dume, on possibility of peace talks with any moderate Taliban.
I just want to say that, you know, we have to keep this term moderate Taliban is quite
it's an oxymoron.
And you have to keep this in perspective, right? I mean, what moderate Taliban might mean, I'll blow up the girl's school instead of shooting a girl in the head for going to school. These are ideologically driven militants. It's certainly true that there are shades of gray among them, but the folks we call the moderate Taliban are really not moderate in any real sense of the word.
Major challenges ahead for Afghanistan, both on the economic and political front. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Kugelman. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, and Sadanand Dume. He's Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you, gentlemen, for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.